Hello and welcome to KUAR's Week in Review podcast for the week ending Friday, April 21st, 2017. I'm Chris Hickey. On this program, we sit down with managing editor of Arkansas Public Media, Bobby Ampazon, and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, reporter for Arkansas Public Media, to talk about the news that has consumed the state this past week, the first execution held in Arkansas in nearly 12 years. We talk about what happened the night of the execution, all the legal developments leading up to it, including decisions by state and federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, and we have a look at next week. Thanks for tuning in. That sound you just heard is the call that Department of Corrections spokesman Solomon Graves received at around 11:56 p.m. on the night of the execution of Liddell Lee, the first Arkansas inmate to be executed in nearly 12 years. The last one was of Eric Nance in 2005. Liddell Lee, one of several men planned to be executed in the state over an 11-day period because of an expiring execution drug, midazolam, a sedative that was supposed to expire at the end of the month. Now, I'm joined here by Bobby Ampazon of Arkansas Public Media, who is there at Cummins Prison Unit down near Grady, Arkansas on Thursday night. Bobby, let's go through this. Liddell Lee was actually supposed to be one of two inmates originally scheduled to die. The other, Stacy Johnson, got a stay from the Arkansas Supreme Court in order to review some DNA evidence from his case. Just give me a sense of the atmosphere first, and then we'll get into some specifics.
Yeah, so let me say that most of the media that converged on the Cummins unit of the prison system here in the state, I think, went into Thursday night's proceedings much the same as Monday night, that is to say, with a real sense of uncertainty. At the time that most media converged on Cummins, there was a stay in place. I think, though, that the state Supreme Court had just overturned that day the circuit court's ruling, Alice Gray's ruling, placing an injunction on the state from using the state's supply of vecuronium bromide that had been sold to it by McKesson.
And this is one of the three drugs, the second of the three drugs.
And not the drug that has been so controversial because it's to expire May 1st. That's midazolam. That's the first drug in the three-drug cocktail. Vecuronium bromide is the second. Potassium chloride is the third. Just as a little bit of backstory, the other two companies, the suppliers for midazolam and the potassium chloride that the state has, have also filed an amicus brief in the case. That is to say, a kind of supporting document, supporting McKesson's stand, trying to get this injunction on one of the state's drugs. But anyway, it didn't work. The state Supreme Court overturned Gray's decision in the circuit court, and that kind of paved the way for Liddell Lee. I just also want to say that these two men, Stacy Johnson and Liddell Lee, they began the week with kind of similar strategies that their lawyers tried to effect, which was to request new DNA testing in the evidence in the case. In Lee's case, there's a strand of hair and a sneaker from the beating death in 1993. That he had asked for new DNA testing. The courts did not side with him, but they did side with Johnson, kind of interestingly. So Johnson's execution didn't go through, while Lee's did. There were, just as there was Monday night, a couple of stays in place. The U.S. Supreme Court, as well as the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals out of St. Louis, both had stays in place well into the 9 o'clock hour. Before it, all of the motions, all of the decision went to the U.S. Supreme Court, who roughly at about 11 p.m. or a little after denied any appeals, and the state was able to carry out the execution.
And according to the witness accounts, the execution went as planned. It was very quick, 12 minutes or so.
Yeah, after the phone call that you played, just moments after, the three media witnesses. Now, folks should know that there are many kind of groups of people or types of people that sit in on an execution. Of course, there's prison staff. There's lawyers. Defense attorney Jeff Rosenzweig was there. There's family of the victim, should they want to be there, can be there. There's also civilian witnesses. These are kind of random people, much like a jury, selected to witness the execution, I think, just for the purpose of transparency and having, again, objective witnesses. And then there's three media witnesses. And the three individuals picked this time were Sean Murphy, an Associated Press reporter out of Oklahoma, for whom this was his 12th execution that he's witnessed. He kind of unfortunately has the execution beat for the Associated Press. John Moritz is a Democrat Gazette reporter who's been writing pretty extensively on the executions. And then Maureen, I'm going to butcher her name, but Glisovic or Glisovic, a TV reporter here locally in Little Rock. They came back and Murphy kind of spoke for the group. He said the inmate's eyes kind of fluttered. He seemed to be asleep within moments of the midazolam. And then within minutes after that, he was dead.
Let's play a little bit of Murphy's witness account.
We entered the execution chamber at about 11:40, the three of us. We were seated in the viewing room with four windows in front of us covered with a black curtain. The curtains opened at about 11:44. DOC director asked inmate Lee if he had any last words, and she actually asked him twice, and he did not respond. And then the warden announced that officials are ready to proceed with the execution, which began at 11:45. Inmate Lee was, his eyes began to droop and then ultimately closed. There was a member of the execution team who performed a consciousness check beginning at about 11:49. He shook the inmate's head, flicked his eyes, appeared to rub his sternum, and the inmate did not appear to be conscious at that point. And then it appears at 11:55, the member of the execution team appeared to do a second consciousness check, and at that point also checked for a heartbeat with his stethoscope, and then called for another member of the execution team, I believe the coroner, to enter the death chamber, and that coroner pronounced inmate Lee dead at 11:56.
All right, Bobby, so we heard there Sean Murphy of the AP kind of describing what happened.
Right, and you can tell that that he thought everything went smoothly. I have to say that Thursday night's proceedings, at least from a media vantage point, were much smoother than Monday night. Monday night, as some folks might be aware, the Department of Correction denied the media witnesses any kind of recording device. And by that, I mean a piece of paper and a pencil. Thursday night was much more deliberate. One other word for folks at home, if I could just kind of talk about what it's like to be a reporter there. You know, if you're a reporter, you go out to something and you report on it, whether it's a crash scene or politics at the Capitol. This kind of coverage is really surreal. You're allowed into the prison. You're welcomed into the visitation center where you proceed to just sit there. Most reporters kind of stay busy with social media, but none of the news that's happening is visible to all but the media witnesses. So it's a really the whole night is about that phone call that began the segment and the brief kind of statements afterward, such as what we just heard from Sean Murphy.
I also want to loop into the conversation Sarah Weitz-Kotacek of Arkansas Public Media. Thanks for joining us. You had a question for Bobby.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the demeanor of the Department of Correction officials. It sounds like you guys were all waiting there for hours and maybe with different assumptions about what might happen throughout the night. But how did they communicate and what was their demeanor?
Department spokesman Solomon Graves, he's a little, how do I put this? He's not a verbose communications director like most media would maybe prefer. It's kind of funny, we made jokes Thursday night that reporters were kind of like puppies and Solomon was like an adult with bacon or treats. You know, every time he came in, we expected him to say something and we literally, we would kind of leap out of our chairs and run to our cameras or microphones or whatever we had. It's just a lot of not knowing, interrupted by these bursts of information that frequently are kind of disappointing, such as the Supreme Court has extended the stay in the execution for half an hour.
I saw on Twitter on Monday night, Jack Jones' execution, which was stayed, that they were serving strawberry cake because that is what he had requested for his last meal. And I found that to be just an odd detail. And I wonder if there was a somber tone in the room, knowing that possibly someone was about to die, and if there was this sort of clashing aspect of a celebration at the same time, because I heard they had like cinnamon rolls last night.
Yeah, it was cinnamon rolls last night. One of the motifs of execution coverage is what is the inmate's last meal? And as we know now, Liddell Lee, and I found it kind of touching, his last meal was communion. He did not request food. He requested communion. On Monday night, it was actually Don Davis. And he did request a few things for his last meal, one of which was a white cake with strawberry icing. Now, we didn't know this until the media arrived at the visitation center, which is kind of the press bullpen that they've set up. And there was this huge sheet of a white cake with strawberry icing, which, you know, just seemed very specific. And I think somebody must have asked and they were like, well, Don Davis requested that, so we have to make a small amount for him. At a prison, you can't make any small amount of food. So this was, well, that quickly got the moniker death cake. And for a long time, nobody touched it. As the night went on, people started getting hungry. And at the very end of the night, about half the cake was gone. But yeah.
Any word from victims' families?
The media witnesses, who'd be the only ones that came into contact with the victim's family in the death chamber Thursday night, didn't know who else in the room was family of the victim. And so they couldn't say. The victim's family did not give comments in the press conference afterward. The press conference was filled out by the media witnesses, J.R. Davis, who's the spokesman for the governor, and very briefly, Solomon Graves, the corrections department spokesman.
Just one more brief comment, Bobby, and then we'll throw it over to Sarah to talk a little bit more about the legal aspects of this case. You're talking about how the media referred to Solomon Graves as handing out treats to a group of puppies, and also to your comment about the communion that Lee requested. I'm reading here this account in the Democrat Gazette that Graves said Lee received a wafer or a piece of bread, and the wine was replaced by either grape juice or water, Graves said. It struck me the lack of specificity there. I don't know what to make of that.
Right. And having covered the two nights of executions this week, I can tell you that I began to get the impression that Graves didn't have answers for all the questions for the same reason any of us didn't, which was Graves mostly spent his night with reporters. So the information he's getting is information called in by another prison staffer or potentially director Wendy Kelly, who was there Thursday night for the execution. In fact, she pronounced the execution successful in the death chamber afterwards. She also did not give comments to the press.
All right. Well, one of the reasons why the execution of Liddell Lee took place at such a late hour of the day is because of what's often referred to as a flurry of legal filings at the last minute by his attorneys. And these appeals went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there were several of them. Sarah, what were these appeals about, and how did the Supreme Court handle them, and how did they fit into the precedent of Supreme Court cases?
Well, the governor's spokesman was on TV last night sort of throwing shade on this legal process and the amount of litigation. Obviously, attorneys are doing everything they can to throw every possible challenge out at the last minute in hopes that that might delay the execution to the point of when the warrant expires at midnight. The State Prosecutors Association also spoke out about that, but ultimately the courts chose to hold the executions and consider every filing that came through.
Let's just jump in here real quick to play you some of J.R. Davis's comments. This is Governor Asa Hutchinson's spokesman.
And the fact that these sentences were handed down decades ago and we're still going through this, and at the last minute it seems to be a lot of things that are being thrown at the wall, see what sticks, hopping on different claims. You know, I think that's the frustrating part. When a sentence is handed down, I think the people of Arkansas expect it to be carried out. And I think when you run into blockades to justice, as I believe the 28 elected prosecutor said today in a letter, that is frustrating for Arkansans, and they lose faith in the justice system, and who could blame them for something like this? Appeals are in place for a reason. You want to make sure that people who are on death row are 100% guilty of the crime they've committed. And in these cases, we are 100% sure that the individuals who are sentenced to death unanimously by a jury, I might add, are guilty of the crimes they were convicted of.
Okay, that was J.R. Davis. Sarah, please continue.
I think the most significant legal update from yesterday was that the U.S. Supreme Court, even before those last-minute appeals, chose not to rule or even hear a federal lawsuit that had been decided in favor of the inmates by a federal judge in Little Rock and then was overturned by the Eighth Circuit. That was about the use of midazolam as an anesthetic. And last night, there were no problems. Lee died. It sounds like 12 minutes was the whole course of the procedure. But there have been other botched executions using midazolam. There's not data using humans on what effect it has on the body. And so lawyers argued that it could cause a cruel and terrifying death. The second and third drugs in the protocol are painful. So if the inmate wasn't made unconscious or sedated thoroughly, they would experience death by suffocation and they could feel quite a bit of pain. And then the other aspects of that case had to do with the schedule that was originally set out for the executions. In dissents about this, Justice Breyer said that he saw this as a reflection of how arbitrary the death penalty is because of, you know, we have so many different stays and so many different cases. And as Bobby mentioned, some are being granted and some are not. And then Justice Sotomayor, her dissent focused on the fact that there is a circuit court split, which is often a reason that the Supreme Court hears cases. And that's having to do with the 6th and 11th Circuit. The 6th Circuit recently ruled in favor of inmates. And that split is about a technicality, which is the only thing the court has ruled about having to do with this protocol. They ruled in an Oklahoma case. And that has to do with whether inmates are required to have an alternative form of death available to them to make midazolam unconstitutional, because the court said, if you don't have another way to go, then we have a right to carry out the death penalty. The court hasn't actually ruled on the science of midazolam, so there was some speculation that they would use this opportunity to weigh in now that there have been more executions that have gone awry and there's been some more evidence since they last took up this issue, that they might pick up Arkansas's case and address that circuit split and address the science issues, and they chose not to. And as many people have pointed out, it was the first ruling of new Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who has restored the 5-4 conservative majority on the court. And that was how the ruling came down yesterday.
Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, you've been in court hearings over the last couple weeks, really, various court hearings, both in that one, that federal court hearing that you mentioned in Little Rock, in which Judge Baker had ruled in favor of the inmates, but it was later overturned. You were also in Pulaski County Court this week in the courtroom of Judge Gray, Alice Gray, in the case brought by the drug supplier McKesson, asking that the state not use its drug that it said was sold under a deceptive agreement with the state. I mean, what's next in terms of legal developments? Obviously, there are a couple of more inmates scheduled to die on Monday. And do they have any appeals left, or what's going on with that?
Well, I think that the most substantive legal challenges have been dismissed. You mentioned the McKesson challenge that succeeded in Pulaski County Court. A company that has a longstanding relationship as a supplier to the ADC was given a order by phone for this drug, vecuronium bromide. They filled it and then later realized that it was going to be used for an execution and wanted it back and were suing to get it back. And in that hearing, there was a dispute, I guess, disputing testimonies between ADC staff and the salesperson for McKesson. ADC staff said, yeah, we absolutely on the phone disclosed that we wanted this for an execution. The salesman said, no, you didn't. These were deceptive practices. So Circuit Court Judge ruled in favor of the company. And to my knowledge, this is the first time that major drug companies have gotten so far in litigating about the use of their drugs in executions.
And Sarah, what I think is interesting about the legal wranglings and the various courtrooms and levels of courts that take up these cases, I think the common myth in America is that the U.S. Supreme Court makes a lot of decisions in any number of ways. And of course, that's true. But as it pertains to these executions, they are deciding, but they're not overturning, right?
Well, so far, the most actualized rulings or appeals and challenges have come at the lower levels, and they're individual stays for inmates like Jason McGeehee, who was granted clemency, and so a federal court said, let's hold off on executing him while that process resolves.
Or, and a federal district court, not...
A federal judge in this Eastern District. And then the DNA case for Stacey Johnson yesterday, that his DNA should be retested, so...
And that's on the state level.
That's the state Supreme Court, which also overturned Gray's decision on McKesson. So to my mind, I think the most influential court, you know, over the last couple of weeks has been the state Supreme Court, which is often overlooked, I think, because they're only the state Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I think, like, obviously this has drawn a large amount of national and international attention, perhaps surprisingly to Arkansas officials. And I think from that vantage point, the question is, will this unprecedented schedule and these executions change the death penalty conversation or the future of the death penalty? And that's where the Supreme Court could have made a big impact and decided not to hear the case. So at this point, it's a non-presence in that sense.
This whole thing started when the governor signed death warrants back in February. It set the schedule. And we keep talking about midnight and how important that is because a death warrant has a date attached to it. A person is to die on this day. And at midnight, of course, the day rolls over, becomes a new day. And legally, it's expired. The death warrant's expired. So,
but he could set a new date, conceivably.
He can, but if he does that, the process for clemency, for sure, as well as I think some other legal kind of mechanisms go into effect. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if he could say, well, it didn't happen today, let's do it on Friday. It wouldn't work that way.
And I think some other useful context for people who are just tuning into this kind of whole topic is that the state hasn't executed anyone in 12 years. And the last time it did, it had a different drug that it used. And that was in an era before this controversy and before drug manufacturers were refusing to the same degree to allow their drugs to be used. So the state was able to use a drug that was more tested, more trusted for what it's doing. And the state hasn't used midazolam before. And part of the rush, obviously, is that our supply of midazolam is about to expire, and Arkansas says it doesn't know if it can get more, and that's part of the issue with rescheduling executions.
And part of the reason it doesn't know if it can get more is because many drug manufacturers or suppliers are based out of Europe, which European countries haven't had the death penalty in decades. So there is kind of an international gulf between, you could say there's an ocean that separates the United States from its European counterparts.
Literal and metaphorical, yes.
And that's a big part of why there's so much urgency and so much anxiety around both these executions and the method of execution.
And we've seen in recent polls that Arkansans are 60% roughly in support of the death penalty.
Yeah, upwards, yeah.
But nationwide, the support has fallen considerably.
Yeah, and there's some polling scientists and pundits who say the polling for the death penalty matters a lot. If you say, should someone who murders get the death penalty, upwards of, say, 60% will say yes. If you say, if someone who murders, should they get the death penalty or at least life imprisonment, or should they rather get life imprisonment instead of the death penalty, it's more like 50-50. It becomes closer to kind of a split decision.
All right. KUAR and Arkansas Public Media will continue to follow the upcoming executions and will be filing stories. And I just want to thank you both, not only for joining me here, but you guys have been doing excellent coverage for Arkansas Public Media, both on a local and national scale. And I think our listeners are really proud of you guys, too.
Well, thanks for holding down the fort last night at KUAR.
Oh, no problem.
And let me just add in 10 seconds, please follow Arkansas Public Media on Twitter and Facebook and visit our website where a lot of our coverage as well as our audio stories can be found.
Bobby Ampazon of Arkansas Public Media, Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, also of APM. Thanks for listening to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Chris Hickey. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, although we are editorially independent. You can find our coverage at KUAR.org, Facebook.com/KUAR Public Radio, or on Twitter at KUAR Public Radio. As you heard, you can also find coverage from our partners, Arkansas Public Media, at ArkansasPublicMedia.org, and you can follow them on Facebook and Twitter as well. Have a great weekend.